remove our shortcomings. So Deborah, we're excited to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Greg, and everybody. So grateful to be here with you on Zoom. Glad that we could work it out. I just was thinking, more and more how my relationship with the steps have changed over the course of my sobriety. I hit my last drink on April 3rd of 87. And I remember when I initially took step 7 and read this chapter, and I attended a Sunday morning step meeting for a number of years on Sunday morning. And all I can say is, in hindsight, the thing I want to say about step 7 is not something that I can work. It's something that works on me. It's not something I can do. It happens to me. It happens to you. Because it says, I was just looking at our step 7 and our 12 and 12. Since this step so specifically concerns itself with humility, we should pause here to consider what humility is and what the practice of it can mean to us. Indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. For without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober at all. Nearly all of AA's have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality, they may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much chance of becoming truly happy. Without it, they cannot live to much useful purpose or in adversity be able to summon the faith that can meet any emergency. So all those words I just read, I can tell you I had no idea what they meant 30 years ago. It means an entirely different thing to me now. Like I said, step 7 is the thing that actually happens to, that's my experience, it happened to me. It's not a step you take once. It's not a one and done step. That's what I'm trying to say. It's not one and done. And the thing of it is, they talk about this in our book on page 72 in the big book, or excuse me, 12 and 12, it says, for us, the process of gaining a new perspective was unbelievably painful. It was only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. Now, I thought this all referred to while drinking, by the way. So it was only at the end of a long road marked by successive defeats and humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency that we began to feel humility as something more than a condition of groveling despair. Every newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous is told and soon realizes for himself that this humble admission of powerlessness over alcohol is his first step toward liberation from its paralyzing grip. Which also brings me to the statement of, I heard this in AA always, alcohol is but a symptom of our disease. And that's what they're referring to here. As I told you over and over again, when I came to AA, I just jumped in. I did not have a relapse. I was really serious about my sobriety, and I wanted to do everything right. And I really believed that a lot of the problems, I thought my problems were caused by drinking, and Only to find down the road in sobriety is that I had other problems. I had problems that were unrelated to drinking. And I was not feeling at 17 years sober how I thought a person at 17 years sober should feel. And this is about the first time I read the article by Bill Wilson on emotional sobriety that we read last time. And I began to, you know, it was a time when I actually got a reboot with my friend Yolanda's Antonio steps. I redid all of them. And I began to develop really a relationship with God, because I didn't have one. I was running around, you know, trying to be perfect, make money. I was worried, obviously, about what everybody thought about me, and I wanted to look good. And so what finally happened 20 years for me, this is my experience in AA, sober. I got into a relationship with a man that I had no business being in, and it ended very badly, and it was a very humiliating experience for me. You know, I should have known better. And I did know better, but I did it anyway. And I guess that to me is so reflective of the insanity that is talked about in step two. You know, I did not realize how deep this disease was. And just knowing that that was not the right thing to do for me, knowing that that was a bad thing to do, you know, wasn't enough to keep me from doing it. It's like I was powerless to make the right decision for myself. And it really, really, really made, I mean, I just hit a really low bottom mentally and emotionally and physically. And I had been sober for 20 years. That's what living life on self-sufficiency brought me, you know, sober, running the show. And so I was just humbler than I ever have been, as humiliated as I ever have been, I should say, and humbled, and did a lot of work with a couple of mentors to improve my conscious contact with God, and to find and to develop a relationship. And I was unprepared for the kind of repeated humiliations and the final crushing. I was unprepared for it, and when it came, it was very painful. That's all I can say. So on page 74, it goes on to say this about all this pain and the humbling. Bottom of page 74, this improved perception of humility starts another revolutionary change in our outlook. Our eyes begin to open to the immense values which have come straight out of painful ego puncturing. Until now, our lives have been largely devoted from running from pain and problems. We fled from them as a plague. We never wanted to deal with the fact of suffering. Escape via the bottle was always our solution. Character building through suffering might be all right for saints, but it certainly did not appeal to us. And boom! You know, in sobriety, I could, what I would say is that obviously the painful ego puncturing came you know, I didn't want to deal with it. And the way I didn't deal with it is that, you know, I looked outside of myself. I was looking always for the worldly clamors to satisfy and fix me. You know, whether it was a new outfit or, you know, the car or the house, whatever it was, you know, the relationship, that's always, was always where I was looking on the outside to fill me up. And obviously that was, you know, at first it was escape via the bottle. It later became the worldly clamors. I used it while sober to satisfy because I did not have a relationship with God. So I think I mentioned this in the very beginning that our fellowship was almost called the James Club in reference to the Bible, the book of James, which starts off with this statement, "Rejoice when you have troubles of any kind." And it's interesting, and it goes on to say that by enduring the troubles and coming out the other side, that you grow in faith in your Father in heaven. Something like that. And, you know, that was not me. I was never a person rejoicing in pain. I was, as the book described, I wanted out of it. I wanted to move on to the next job, the next relationship, the next. That was me. And finally, it says here, we see we needn't always be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. And it could come quite as much from our voluntary reaching for it as it could from unremitting suffering. A great turning point in our lives came when we sought humility as something we really wanted, rather as something we must have. It marked the first time when we could commence to see the full implication of step 7, humbly asking to remove our shortcomings. Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, all of that. But I certainly did not get that in the beginning, and had to have a lot more painful ego puncturing and crushing experiences during my sobriety. You know, and I now know that, you know, this is a common occurrence to people. I mean, I'm not the only person who's had this problem. A lot of people go back out, or they kill them, you know, they commit suicide or something, because this disease that I have is so much more than just about drinking or not drinking. This step 7, 6, and 7 for me are the ongoing work of trying to find, develop, and maintain emotional sobriety. I had physical sobriety, and I'm so grateful for it, but there is so much more to this program. And I can't say to you now, today, how I thought I was open-minded, but as where God was concerned, I guess I thought I knew better. I thought I knew, you know, and as I'm sure most of you know, in our big book, it talks about Roland Hazard, the very wealthy businessman who was a hopeless alcoholic, friend of Bill W.'s, went to study with Carl Jung for a year in Europe, and he was sober during that time, and then he, when he was released, he drank, and he came back to the doctor and was, you know, just said, oh, is there no hope? Whatever. And Dr. Young said that, once in a while, there are phenomena that occur with alcoholics where they are, old ideas are replaced with new ideas, and there's an, I can't think now, I'm sorry. I'm totally screwing it up. But that the old self dies to the new spiritual self. And that is what my experience has been. I didn't know. And it's not about self-knowledge. It's not about how much you know. That's not how much I know. None of this is about how smart I am or not. It says here in our book, too, that the chief activator of our defects has been self-centered fear, primarily fear that we would lose something we already possessed or would fail to get something we demanded. Living upon a basis of unsatisfied demands, we are in a state of continual disturbance and frustration. Therefore, no peace was to be had unless we could find a means of reducing these demands. The difference between a demand and a simple request is plain to anyone. Seventh step is where we make the change in our attitude, which permits us, with humility as our guide, to move out from ourselves toward others and toward God. The whole emphasis of step seven is on humility. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. That is what it has come to mean for me today. And, certainly not perfect, but I have finally achieved a certain level of relief from some of the more crippling defects that I had. And, I'm just so grateful because it was through this program that I was able to have a second chance in my sobriety. Very grateful. And let's see here. I had to become willing to have God remove the defects just as I did for him to remove the booze. And there is a prayer in our big book, 4-Step 7. A lot of people do it with their sponsor formally, which I did in the beginning. I thought, that's that. Did step seven. But now I know. It's been an ongoing process. And the humility is something I guess you earn the hard way. And that's all I have to say about humility tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to open this up to questions and answers. So anybody here in the room or anybody at home on Zoom may ask a question. If you're on Zoom, just go ahead and unmute yourself and ask your question when you're ready. Who's going to get us started? All right, Ryan's got us here in the room.
Hello, I'm Ryan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ryan.
How do you practice step seven with sponsees? I mean, is there anything in particular that you do or just generally? Thanks.
Well, I guess, the thing that I... basically going through step seven, reading the prayer, etc. But, as life, as people move on in their sobriety and life is, they're living life, and all the vagaries of life come upon, I just talk about my experience in sobriety, handling life, I did not do a lot of things. I did a lot of things wrong because I was just so full of self. And so the only thing I can share is that, and what I do share is that this is why they say in step seven that it's repeated humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And, you know, being humble or teaching step seven, as I said, I mean, it isn't really something you can teach. Step seven is something that happens to you as you're going out and living your life and interacting with, and that's how it was for me, and realizing, oh gosh, you know, how wrong I was about a lot of things that before I knew I was absolutely right. And I can only talk about my experience with it, so I hope that helps.
Hi, Deborah. I'm Leslie, alcoholic, and thank you again. Thank you again. I've enjoyed all of your leads on each of the steps, and I'm benefiting, I feel, from them. But my question is this. I mean, step seven, as you describe it, is a kind of a subtle thing and a something that kind of grows as we live. And I was wondering if there is any actual either daily or repeated practice you do as far as program that helps keep those that surrender in mind, you know, that helps bring, you know, I mean, I can't surrender something till I really become aware of it, but, you know, becoming aware of it sometimes grows out of things that I do in practice, and I was wondering what you had to say about that as far as, you know, what do you do that kind of keeps your mind fresh and keeps the heart open to those things?
Well, I mean, you know, and of course, when we go on in the steps, step 10, it talks about, you know, trying not to become disturbed. And what do I do now? I mean, basically, it's a practice for me of not reacting to everything. You know, I called myself before step seven. I was like an amoeba. You know, if you ever looked at one in a microscope and it's all wiggly, and then you touch it with something and it does that. That was me. That's how I was. I reacted to everything. And so, you know what? I can't believe that finally it happened, because sometimes I can pause, and sometimes I can bite my tongue. Not all the time. I've been told I don't have much of a filter, but I'm so much better than I used to be. So you can imagine what I was like. And so, you know, every day I do readings, and I just, throughout the day, I just, you know, I try not to dwell on that I can't. You know, like all this crazy political crap and everything. I just, my TV and my radio, everything are turned off. And I just can't do it, because it gets me disturbed. And that's never a good thing, because then I start reacting. And when something comes up, I really have found the power of prayer and praying for people in certain situations, and it really does work. It really does work, and that's what I do.
Thank you. Who else has a question for Deborah?
Anybody at home on Zoom? All right, Kevin. Kevin's got a question.
Of course he does.
Thanks, Deborah. I really appreciate this. This is quite of an experience over here on this side. I don't know what it's like there, but...
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at the back of a monitor, so I can't see the back of your head. So, anyway, step seven talks about, it says, you know, humbly ask that God remove your shortcomings. When you realize that something is a shortcoming in you, I know for myself, when I was first sober, I thought that it took me a long time to hear what the step actually said, to have God remove this thing, and I thought it was my part to remove this. And it took me a long time before I actually had to let go, and I was wondering what your process was. And I mean, it took me a long time to realize that step seven was not my responsibility. It was more my awareness. And with that awareness, what was your action that you took as a result of understanding that it was not your responsibility, but God was removing these shortcomings? And how was your relationship with your higher power in step seven?
Yeah, I the thing that comes to mind is it's just a continual surrender. This program is one surrender after another. And for me, it has been that way. On my knees, at the end of step four and five in the big book, it talks about, you know, when fears come up, we ask God to remove our fear, direct our attention to what he would have us be. And I pretty much do that for everything. And so if I find myself being critical or fearful or angry or any of the things, emotions that pop up, that's pretty much what I do. Sometimes I hit my knees, sometimes I don't, but I focus on asking God to please remove it, you know, and direct my attention to what he would have me be, because I don't want to be like that either. You know, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the same old behaviors, for myself even. And so I know that, you know, my way doesn't work. My trying to change myself does not work. And this has worked for me. And it's about really just being receptive, surrendering my old ideas to the new idea and going with it, and wherever that goes. And it's a practice. Step seven is a practice. That's what I'll say.
Anyone else? Kevin's got another one.
Yeah.
My show doesn't start till 8:30, so I've got plenty of time. Anyway, I would like to know, you mentioned, you talked a couple of different times about the seven-step prayer. Could you expand on, you know, your thoughts as you are doing the seven-step prayer? I mean, if you do it just remotely, or what are your thoughts as you're doing and saying the seven-step prayer on your knees, right?
Yeah, I haven't done it for a while. I mean, I don't really recite that prayer. I did for the longest time. I'm looking for it here in my book. having a hard time finding it right now, but hold on a second. Oh, in the world. Oh, here, when ready. I'm not close at all. I'm sorry. Well, I obviously, it's been a long time since I've recited the seven-step prayer. But what I know is that a lot of the things I thought I liked about myself, I found out are not my greatest assets. And, you know, being sarcastic, some of the things I thought were funny are not to other people, and in fact are hurtful. And it's one example of, that's what the seventh step means to me, is to ask God to remove that shortcoming. And ask to know what his will is in my life. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I don't know. And when I say that, and since I have been saying that, my life has taken an unbelievable turn in a way I never would have imagined. And I am only speaking just based on my experience, that it has, you know, been an ongoing effort to try to not get perfect, but to be more of the person God created me to be.
Anyone else? Last call. All right. Thank you, Deborah.